I don't know, of all the
people. Does that mean that there were many political discussions in your household during your childhood and youth?
Well, I think my father was somewhat politically alive. I don't think he was active in political parties. He tried his hand at moonlighting and trying to make a fortune on the stock exchange and in speculative oils and things of that sort, and lost a lot of money. He was always active in church politics, which are, you know, fairly political, which I followed to some degree, not all that much.
But it meant that by the time of the discussions around the war and Hitler, you had already had a fair exposure to...
Oh, yeah, I took a very lively interest in foreign affairs. That's maybe one reason I abandoned English for social sciences, too. Became very interested in that. And it was the student body was very, very active in a lot of anti-war sentiment against committing us to the war. And a lot of the instructors were very pro-involvement against fascism and so on. Brought in a lot of speakers to justify our involving. We had a couple people that had been in the Lincoln Brigade that came over as students. I didn't get to know them all that well. I think a member of the history faculty was probably a member of the Communist Party, and I look back on it now. But I wasn't terribly taken with that or terribly active. And then my socialism was very, very, very unsystematic. And it was probably more anti-war than anything else. But I grew up very much in that kind of thing. I'm very much opposed to all of the ending of neutrality legislation and all of that. Futilely, as it turned out. Rather anti-Roosevelt because of his involvement for that reason, though the New Deal had made a favorable impact on people. And I'm very much torn about Roosevelt and why he was doing some of the things he was doing. I remember all of that. So a lot of discussion. And in the second, probably I should mention that my college career was probably dominated by the fact that in the second year I went to school, I met my wife, and we became engaged within about 2 years, but we'd gone steadily together, so that more or less dominated a lot of my college days. I worked a little on the college newspaper.
She
lived in Wauwatosa, which is a suburb of Milwaukee, which is hard to get to from where we lived. She was about an hour and a quarter away, too, but in a different direction, off in another direction of the metropolitan area.
And was she very active in some political discussions, too?
I don't think she was as politically oriented. We talk politics a lot, but that's probably my motivation more than hers.
Yes.
But of course we began worrying about the war and possibility of being drafted, mm-hmm. and what about our future. And these things became quite a big cloud over everybody's private lives, as it turned out.
At what point did you decide then to go on to graduate school and not to just pursue your getting your credentials?
Well, when I began working at the post office, I simultaneously dropped out of the student teaching. The man who ran the secondary student teaching program was a very, from my point of view, unattractive person. I found it very hard to live with that guy. And my wife had difficulty with him, too, for one reason or another. So that was a problem because he was very much in command. It was a fairly small program, and he was very much in command of that program. So I think it raised, there were problems in my mind about it. Then I decided that what good was it to be either in history or English? If you're going into the wars, why that would be of no use at all. Then I'd have a lot of math and a little bit of science, and I decided to step up my science training. So I kind of shunted away completing my degree and dropped out of the student teaching program. postponed it, is all you could do, of course, technically, and began working on in science and math, and eventually got into the Signal Corps and went into an electronics training program as a result of that, which was my way to pursue the war in the least undesirable way. So I did that. Plus the fact working at the post office made it very difficult for me to do a student teaching commitment. By that time I more or less decided that I really didn't want to go into secondary teaching, I didn't think. Began to think about what I would do beyond that, maybe going to college teaching. So vaguely I had that notion, but I had no idea about graduate schools either, mind you, at this point, and how to pursue that either. I said this was not done that much, and there weren't so many people doing it that, you know, you could just turn and get information. And so I drifted really out of fake commitment to high school teaching for a variety of reasons. And we're sort of at loose ends. The war just put people at loose ends, in a sense. And once I finished military service, then I had accumulated the famous GI Bill rights, and I had about 4.5 years of graduate support, which I could count upon. So while I was in the service, I thought about what I was going to do. My choices were between staying with electronics and science, or going back into history. And I decided to go back into history.
Were you married when you went into service?
No. I was married during the time I was in the service. My wife and I were married in Georgia at a Air Force base near Macon, Georgia. We married and in that part of the world. So,
but you went into the service in what year then?
Oh gosh, you asked me these years. I don't even remember my own life very well. Let's see, I started college in 38. Never finished and got my degree. I was given a degree because I completed 140-some units, but never the student teaching, which was, you know, the ultimate. But I think they decided that people that were drafted or entered the military and had done reasonably well and had done a certain number of units could be given their degrees by the university, by the college. So I got it sort of by curious device. So I must have been really there 4 years. And I accumulated more than the necessary units by going to summer schools and things. So I must have entered in 1942.
And you were in the service for how long?
Came out in January 46. I went immediately to the University of Wisconsin and started the second semester of that year.
Now, how did you, was that just a logical choice to go to the University of Wisconsin?
I had a vague notion that they had a pretty good history department, but I didn't, we were overseas, I had no way of researching graduate schools or anything else, and as I said, really not very knowledgeable about how you pursue choosing a graduate school. So I went to Wisconsin because I was a Wisconsin person that was university.
Was your wife teaching during this period?
Yeah, she, as a matter of fact, she graduated a year after I did and got a job teaching in a little high school in northern Wisconsin near Wausau, a place called Edgar, and ultimately transferred down to a place quite close to Madison called Mazamani. By that time, we decided I'd probably go to Madison, and so she had a job fairly close to the university. So she taught 2 years, pretty close, 2.5 years.
Right. So you entered your graduate program in history then,
mm-hmm.
straight out of the...
Right. Yeah. My intention was to go into European history. I really didn't like the person I would have had to work with too well. I was conscious of the fact that the man with one of the big reputations was Paul Naplan, who was head of the department. So that's how I got into English history. He happened to be in the British Empire field. You know why I chose British Empire English history. You know, I had no interest in England before going to graduate school. But anyway, I eventually got into English history. Worked with Bill Saxey, who, of course, authored this book I have on my, and with Maplin mainly. But I had fields in Far Eastern history, and I had a field in modern Europe. We had to have a medieval or ancient field, and mine was in medieval England, early English history. And we had to have six fields, and two subsidiary outside fields. Different than graduate training became. They expected us to be rather broadly trained. So I had British Empire and two British fields, a European field, a Far Eastern field, and a U.S. foreign policy. U.S. history was broken into 101 different pieces. So, I'd done all this, and that was my array. And the other work I did was in political theory on international relations in the poli sci department.
Well, most of your peers in graduate school, married, veterans, returning?
A lot of them were married. Not all were, but they were most of them veterans. Most of the awful large percentage of people were on the GI Bill. Perfectly normal. But the graduate school of Wisconsin was relatively small. Now, if I had to make a guess, I'd say there were something like 25 or 30 graduate students when I was there. And I got to know the ones mainly in English history and in European history. And the U.S. people formed a little club of their own. They were off here, and the rest of us were off there, sort of. There weren't many working in the ancient. There were very few working. Nobody was in Far Eastern yet. Very small handful in European and a few in English history, and that was it.
Yeah.
It was, you know, when I think of what Wisconsin became, and, you know, having several hundred graduate students, it's inconceivable because we were a small crew. We were all housed in one little corner of Bascom Hall. And I knew that, you know, the faculty in history, it couldn't have been more than a dozen or so if I were to tick them off. So you got to know almost all of them. There were only one or two that I didn't take courses from because they were completely outside my field. But Fred Harrington, later president of the university, was teaching U.S. history at the time, and indeed he was my mentor in the field. And there were two people in English history. And that's all. A medievalist, an early modern person. Higbee and Eason were modern European history. Curdy was there, well known in U.S. history, intellectual history. Heseltine was there. Jensen was there. Man at Far Eastern East was Eugene Borgman, who was just newly come in from the university from Harvard. I got to know him quite well. I worked for him as a graduate assistant and for Saxey. But it was a good experience in two ways. It was a small enough group so that it was intellectually cohesive. We interacted a lot and had a chance to work together and a lot. Got to know most of the faculty. I understand it became a great mill ultimately, but it wasn't at that time. It's amazing how small it is now that I've come to think about it.
Well, and since you have to have these six areas, too, you would have contact with practically everybody on the faculty.
Yeah. I got to know some of the people in the econ department. My wife decided to do graduate work in economics. So she started out in economics at the same time I did. She never finished because we left and went to England when I got to do my graduate research. And she wasn't quite ready to do her prelims yet. I hurried my prelims along and got on out. But
now, the GI Bill was able to support the two of you in graduate school?
Well, I had a graduate teaching assistantship, and she worked for the Bureau of Business Research, and sometimes she read papers for in the big sections in Econ. I don't know who's the man in Wisconsin that produced a textbook that was used for years and years and years. Well, she worked for him in a big lecture section. So that between the two of us, we were able to save some money. And I eventually set off for England to do my doctoral research. I'd applied for a Fulbright, didn't know I got it till I got to England. Somebody got a hold of me in London and said, "Oh, I like a Fulbright." And I said, "Well, that'd be great."
How did you come to pick your thesis topic?
Well, Napland had a sort of, you know, your mentors have a list of possible topics. And he tried to get somebody a couple of years before to work on Joseph Chamberlain. And for some reason, he started out several students on this topic, and they'd all, for one reason or another, quit. And so it was still a going topic, and he mentioned that this was a possibility. So I decided to work on Joe Chamberlain. He'd run some seminars in the late 19th century, and he was really, his field of specialization was Gladstone. And he'd done some writing on Gladstone's foreign policy and imperial policy. So he was in the 19th century, and the seminars were mainly in that period. And so I worked in the period, and I was kind of interested in it. And the archives had just recently opened until 1902, and Chamberlain's period was 95 to 1902, so there was a logic in choosing a topic which was sort of at the frontier where the archives were. And if you have to work on a figure in British imperial history, why, it's about as big a one as you can pick. So it was in that sense a good topic. And it was a topic that had plenty of potential for the future.
And your expectation was that you would be over there for a year doing research?
Yeah, that was the idea. When I got over there, I found that the Colonial Office archives were enormous. There was no way that one could examine them except on a sampling basis. And I could have held to a game plan and just sampled the archives. Instead, I decided to focus on the South African question and the South African war, Boer War. So that's what I actually wrote on. And I examined all the records on that topic. And then I stayed a second year, partly to finish my research, but partly to develop additional material so when I got back, I would have a scholarly career ahead of me. I wouldn't have just this one thing. And I collected, God knows, all sorts of material. When I was over there, I was assigned to, I worked out of the University of London. We had to have a English assignment. I was doing my dissertation, and I did it by mail. I'd write pieces of it and send it off to Napland. He'd read it and send them back. And he was very good. He read them quickly and send them back. He was a very easy man to work for. He wanted to get his students through and, you know. Yeah, he was systematic, and like, unlike some people, where he'd make you revise and revise forever. He'd say, "Well, at some point, it isn't perfect, but you're going to do more work on it." Yeah, you have to get out. So he was a good practical person to work for. So I did this, and so I did research. But in my attachment to the university, I was at the Institute of Historical Research, which was kind of a new invention. And it was an English effort to kind of adapt the American type of seminar instruction for graduate instruction. And so I became a part of seminars and so on, which were really kind of a new idea at that time. And London was kind of a new and experimental. I don't think they were doing it at Oxford and Cambridge yet. So here I was at the University of London. Of course, the British Museum was there, and the Public Record Office was there, and the archives were there, so that was the logic of being attached. But they had to find a mentor for me. Well, I was assigned to Dame Lillian Penson. Whether she was Dame at the time, I don't know. But she was the executive head of the University of London, which is an elective office. That was her elected year, either a year or 2 years. Well, Dame Lillian Penson was somewhat like God Almighty. She was a long way away. I remember I would get in to see her on occasion, and she would give me 10 or 15 minutes of her time, and invariably end by saying, "Write me a dear note." So I'd write her a dear note. I didn't get to know Dave Marie and Benson very well. But she had people that were sitting in for her in her seminars, some of her advanced students. I didn't get to know a chap by the name of Graham, who was at King's College, and he sort of became a secondary sort. And I got to know Taylor Milne, who was the executive secretary of the Institute of Historical Research in London. And when I had problems, I used to go to him. He knew the curious ways of the English and the archives and all the rest. So I found my way around by devices such as that. But Dame Lillian Fenson was never much used to me, except to impress me with the fact that she was a mighty person and she was a long way away. Oh, dear.
You spent what, 2 years over there then?
Well, let's see, we went over in 49 and I stayed until 51. My Fulbright was only for 1 year. The second year I was on a fellowship from a research fellowship from Wisconsin.
But when you came back with dissertation completed then?
Right.
Plus additional.
Yeah, I sent it ahead of me and it was completed in the spring and I came back to take my RLs in the early spring and stayed with my folks in Milwaukee. Well, we spent part of the time there, part with my wife's folks in Wauwatosa. Kind of just in a holding pattern to see if I could turn out the job. Well, I should tell you the story of getting this job, I suppose. And by the way, my wife attended the seminars at the London School of Economics. That also helped me with my research. So she kind of abandoned her own work in order to get me finished. I don't know if that ever was a terrible. She never really seems to complain about that. I think she kind of exhausted her interest in economics after about 3 years of it, but I'm not sure. She hasn't really been terribly interested in it since. Her real interest is horses, as it turns out. So. And that she had to postpone while there was family around. And as soon as family was old enough, then she got a horse. And so we've been at horses ever since.
Oh.
That's her great interest. Economics has become a secondary interest. Well, she did teach a little bit in community colleges here for a while in econ and business. But anyway.
So she kind of slipped out of it rather than making a specific choice to not pursue it.
Oh, I think so, yeah. We've been married for almost 7 years and decided, well, if we're going to have a family, we better get at it. So, then we made that decision. She was actually pregnant when we came back from Europe. So we were kind of hoping we'd get a job.
So when you came back, you had no notion of what the job market was like or where you would go?
No, I remember making jokes that I'd get a job in some ungodly place like California or Texas or someplace like that, but it didn't really seem to me that wasn't such a good idea. The Golden Gate looked good when I came back from San Francisco, but otherwise California hadn't made that much of an impression on me. Well, anyway. But there weren't many jobs. That was a bad year to come out in 51. There were very few opportunities posted in the history department. But we were told one day there was this man who said he was the president of a university, of a college back in California, which nobody had heard of. Literally, nobody had heard of it. But they thought maybe San Francisco, San Diego State were kind of related, and it was some new place that sprung up down in Los Angeles somewhere. I went to see him. That was an interview. We talked about my religion and my background. We talked about everything that was inappropriate to talk about, mind you, in a state institution, and lots of other things. But the one thing he liked, I'd been everywhere he wanted me to teach. He wanted me to teach about the Far East, I'd been there. He wanted me to teach about Europe, I'd been there. He thought if you were there, you must know. He didn't have much use for historians, but if you'd been there, you must know something. So I lucked out, and I remember all the other students, they were just, envious as can be. The hideous thing was paid all of $4,300, and there weren't many jobs, and I was lucky. I got a telegram from this fellow. He did seem improbable, and he didn't seem to be my model of a college president, and I wasn't sure he was. I got a telegram saying that I accept the job. So then I began to seriously be concerned of whether there was such a place, whether we had been all been victimized. You know, you could find out nothing about the place, not a thing. City College in Long Beach, people knew about, but nobody knew about this place. Nobody. I suppose Irv told you an even more improbable tale about being hired. Well, anyway.
This was you didn't even know where to direct him to.
Yeah, well, I had a terrible time finding the apartments, and ultimately we did find them. I remember the first person to talk to me was Hugh Brown, who was the...
He was one of the first to go. Yeah,
Hugh and Pearson fell out. But Hugh Brown talked to me, and he made the assignments. He was sort of the chief executive and made the assignments. He looked at my record, and I, you know, he gave me the distinct impression that he thought the president had surely made a mistake. Well, for one thing, it didn't look like we needed two English historians in the first four faculty we had. And they'd hired Kimball, they'd hired me in the same year. And so they had Malin and Alquist, and then they hired Kimball. We were both in English history.
Irv talked about that.
Oh,
yeah. Were two people in each team.
Oh, yeah. Well, anyway, that was a real joke. But anyway, I got assigned to teach U.S. history, and they had a course called History of the Pacific, which dated from Dumpty and Hardy, who wrote a book on this. And I said, Pacific, you know, who? You know, here we have Japan and China and all these major civilizations. We're going to teach about the Pacific. I changed it to Far Eastern history. Boy, it wasn't immediately. So I did that, and then I did Renaissance Europe, 19th century Europe, 20th century Europe, U.S. history, English history, so on. Far East.